Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program, brought to you from the historic Hoover Theater in San Jose. My name's Terry Christensen, and it's my pleasure to introduce George Lakoff, co-author with Elizabeth Vailing of The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic. Dr. Lakoff is widely recognized for applying theories of cognitive behavior to better understand political philosophy and behavior. He joined the UC Berkeley faculty in 1972, and is currently the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Distinguished Professor of Cognitive Science and Linguistics. Dr. Lakoff has taught at Harvard University and the University of Michigan, and he was a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study at Stanford, and he's also the founder of the Rockridge Institute, and he's written several influential books, including Moral Politics, Don't Think of an Elephant, and The Political Mind. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. George Lakoff.
Thank you, Terry, and thank you all for coming. The Commonwealth Club is a remarkable organization, and the fact that you're here tonight on a Tuesday night shows how remarkable it is. This is a place where we get to talk, and I'll talk briefly for a while, and then we will all talk together. This book is meant to fit in your pocket, and let me tell you a bit about how it occurred. I study the mind and language. I study how the brain does thought and language. That's what I do at Berkeley. And that has everything to do with politics in the following way. Every thought you have is physical. It's done in neural circuitry in your brain. You have no choice. It's all physical. And that circuitry works in ways that we weren't brought up to understand. We've begun to understand it in the last couple of decades. And one of the things that we've understood is, first, that about 98% of thought is unconscious. You don't most mainly know what's going on. It's below the level of consciousness in your brain. And that's sometimes scary, but it's there. It's just a fact. Secondly, when you think in terms of structures called frames. And frames are the normal things you think in terms of. And all words are defined in terms of these frames. The frames are neural circuits, and they have a certain structure. For example, you could imagine a restaurant frame in which you go into a restaurant and you know things that are there. There are waiters, there are menus, there are cooks, there are dishes, there's a check that comes, and so on. These are frame elements. Notice what there isn't in a normal restaurant frame. There aren't elephants, motorcycle races, or other things in most normal restaurant frames. And you know what's inside, you know what's outside, you know how it operates, and it's a structure that you've learned. It's ordinary. Framing is normal. You can't think without frames. You can't talk without them. They're the most normal things in the world. And one of the first things you learn is that when you negate a frame, you activate the frame. That's why I wrote a book called Don't Think of an Elephant. Right? You think of an elephant if I tell you not to think of an elephant. Try it. Now, the big thing about it is that all frames come in structures that are hierarchical. And in politics, those frames have a hierarchical structure where the moral frames are at the top. And the reason for this is very simple. All politics is moral. So anybody who's running for office says, do what I do because it's right. Nobody says, do what I do because it's wrong. It's evil. Do it. Nobody says that. Nobody says, do what I do because it doesn't matter. They don't say anything like that. They assume that you're supposed to do what they do because it's right. That means that there's a moral frame and a set of moral frames that lie behind the language that is used and the frames that are there. And that's extremely important. What we are experiencing in America right now is that a lot of people have different moral frames. There is not a single morality out there. There are actually two conflicting ones. But one of the most interesting things about it, and we'll get to conservative and progressive moralities in a while, one of the most interesting things about it is that many people, if not most, have both frames at once. That is, many people are conservative about some things and progressive about other things. How is it possible that you could have two conflicting moral systems at once in the same brain? And the answer is simple. Since it's a neural circuit, there are simple neural circuits called mutually inhibitory circuits. Activate one, it turns off the other. And the more you activate one, the stronger it gets. So if you hear language that is either mostly progressive or mostly conservative, then what's going to happen is that's going to strengthen that moral system in your brain. That is normal. It's going to happen. You have no choice about it. So the question is, how does this work? And notice that there's a consequence. Let's suppose that you're conservative and that what you're trying to do is convince people who have both of these systems in their brains to be on your side. What do? You invent conservative language that will use conservative framing, and you repeat that language over and over so that people will hear it. And if they have both systems in their brains, the conservative system will be strengthened. And in fact, that has happened a lot. What's happened is that conservatives, over the past 30 to 40 years, have set up a communication system in this country that is much more elaborate than any progressive system. And it's not just Fox News or things like that. That's the tip of the iceberg. It's a very elaborate communication system. And they have figured out how to use language in a way that frames most issues from their point of view. And that is something that's disturbing to me as a progressive Democrat. I see this happening, and I see progressive Democrats hearing their language and starting to use it, and then starting to think in terms of those frames. And we'll get into exactly what they are, but they're frames that have to do with, let's say, getting rid of pensions. Right? Now, let's think for a minute, what is a pension? A pension is delayed payment for work already done. Right? If you work all your life, you've got a pension. Not only that, you've got a contract for it. To get rid of pensions is to either, if you haven't hired someone, to either change the contract, or to get rid of pensions, it's to not pay you for work already done. That's remarkable. It's not said that way. But that is a reality of pensions. And it's not just pensions, it's a lot of things. So what the Little Blue Book is about is the following. It addresses the problem that Democrats have, which is that conservative Republicans have established the framing for issue after issue after issue and established the language for it. And the question is, what do you do in those situations? And this book attempts to give you an answer to that. And the answer to that is not obvious and it's not simple, but it's not that hard to do as soon as you understand it. The answer is, one, to understand what your moral system is. I mean, you might be a conservative, you might be a liberal, but the question is, how do you understand exactly what you believe? And what these things are described in the book. In addition to that, what we have found on the Democratic side is that a lot of Democrats are not stating deep truths. And that's important. Democrats tend to talk about issues, and they tend to talk about policies and facts, and they'll give you the facts and the figures to support their policies. But they don't tend to talk about the moral basis of the policy, and they don't tend to talk about deep truths that go across different policies. So what this book attempts to do is to get at those deep truths, to say what they are, and to tell you, if you're interested, if you're a Democrat, how to talk about them. And if you're a Republican, to have to face them and to ask, do you believe them or not? So that's what this is about. It's a very inexpensive book. I think they're charging $10 tonight. It'll fit in your pocket. In fact, actually fits in mine, except it's somewhere here. Here it is. It fits in my pocket. So that's the idea. So let me begin by talking about two moral systems. And I'm not going to go through the whole more complicated version. I'll give you a shorter version of them because I don't want to talk that long. Think about what democracy is about. Democracy in this country was founded on the idea that citizens care about each other and act responsibly on that care. And in doing so, the way they do it is they act through a government. And that government has certain moral responsibilities, namely to protect all citizens equally and to empower all citizens equally. Those are the moral responsibilities of a government. And the way this has worked out from the beginning of this country is through a concept of the public. What the public does is provide things for everyone equally. The typical roads and bridges cases. You came here on a road, right? You didn't build it. Other people did. There are, luckily, sewers here. You didn't build them. Other people did. You can drink clean water. You didn't build the pipes for the water and getting them here. Other people did. The public did that. But also, think about airplanes, for example. They were initially designed and built and supported in through the military and through the government. Airplane pilots are trained largely through the Air Force. You know, the airlines mostly don't train their own pilots. They're trained initially through the airport. They get the Air Force. Think about virtually anything that goes on. You have public parks, public education. If you have a company and you hire workers who are educated, chances are you didn't educate them. And if they went to private schools, you probably didn't educate their teachers or build the school buildings. Those were built by the public. Hospitals built by the public, and on and on and on. The Center for Disease Control. Think about all of the ways in which the public protects food, the Food and Drug Administration, for example. As soon as you start thinking about anything you do every day, there is something about the public there. That is, if you run a company and you do very well, you work hard, you built this company and you deserved to build this company, terrific. Or you've got a job in a company and you're working for that, or a job in a business, wonderful. And you've worked very hard. You probably haven't even noticed what the public has given. You probably, you come there on the roads, the trucks bring things on the roads, or you send them out on the roads. You didn't ask how the roads got there. You just use them. You know, you don't ask how the airplanes got there or the pilots got trained. You just use them. But the fact is that without the public, the private can't exist in any decent way. You can't live a decent private life without all those things that have been provided by the public. And you can't run a business. All private enterprise requires a previous contributions by the public. Right? So this is a very important truth as soon as you look around you and so on. And it comes from a moral principle on which the country was founded. Namely, people, citizens care about each other and set up a government that provides for the public. And that's how people care about each other. That's how they protect and empower everybody equally. That's the mechanism. But there are other folks called conservatives who don't believe that the country, that democracy is about that. They believe that democracy is about what is called liberty, the liberty to pursue your own interests and your own well-being without bearing any responsibility for the well-being and interests of other people. That is, you have personal responsibility, but not social responsibility under that view. And under that view, the public shouldn't exist. You should all do it yourself. And the assumption is that if you've done well in life, you have done it yourself for an interesting reason. That if you really believe that down deep, if that's all you believe, you won't notice the public. You won't even see it. You'll hear my talk and it'll go in one ear and out the other for a very good reason. And it has to do with the brain. You can only understand what your brain allows you to understand. You can only understand what the moral frames and the political frames of your brain allow you to understand. That those circuits and those frames are there, they're physical in your brain, and you can't even make sense of stuff that does not fit the circuitry of your brain. And what's happening now in this country is a lot of people who are almost all totally conservative don't see that. And even if they hear it, it'll go in one ear and out the other. And that is what happened last week. Last week, President Obama gave a talk in Roanoke, Virginia. And in that talk, he talked about this issue and about what businesses get from other safe citizens joining together through the government to provide. And in that speech, he mentioned what I just mentioned. And he said a sentence that was ambiguous. The sentence was, he talked about, you built a business, you didn't make the roads, you didn't, you didn't invent the internet, it was a government job, the government invented the ARPANET, which became the internet, and so on, so businesses can use it, right? And then he said, if you built a business, you didn't build that, where that refers to all those public provisions. This snippet was taken out by Fox News, and then fed to people on Fox News, to Rush Limbaugh, to Glenn Beck, to people who were in the press, and to Mitt Romney. And it was as if that meant the business. It's as if he had said, if you built that business, you didn't build that business, which makes no sense, and he didn't say that. But that was what the snippet was. And that was a case of conservatives hearing that, assuming something crazy. I mean, that's not what the president said or what anyone else said. But it had to do with the fact that they're not noticing what he did say. They're not noticing that you don't build a business on your own. That you need all sorts of other stuff in addition to all the work you do on your own. Which is what he did say. Now, that is very important for a number of reasons. First of all, if you pay your taxes and pay fees and whatever it is, whatever revenue the government collects, it uses that revenue for the public. And often it hires private contractors. If you build roads, you're going to hire lots of local people. If you're sponsoring research, you're going to hire people in universities and in research centers and so on. So you're going to have private contractors, whatever. You're going to be helping the private in that way. But in another way, the question is, what is the limitation on privatization? Right now, what conservatives are saying, they don't think that the public is legitimate. That everything should be privatized. Education should be privatized. Health should be completely privatized. It's now mostly privatized. They believe more and more things should be privatized. Public parks should be privatized. National monuments should be privatized, and so on. That is part of what they believe. So the question is, if privatization is happening anyway, and it has to, and it should, when it's a pragmatic thing, you got to build a road, you got to hire some people. if that's happening anyway, what are the limits? Are there things you should not privatize? And there's an answer to that, and it's very simple and straightforward. You should not privatize any enterprise which is fundamentally moral. Right? What's fundamentally moral? Health, education, all sorts of things that where if you privatize it, it will be done for the sake of someone else's profit, not for your benefit. And that's important because moral issues are done for the sake of everybody's benefit. So there is a line to be drawn here, and it's a very important line as to what should and should not be privatized. Now, there's a further part of this that's very important, and it has to do with the role of corporations. One of the things that conservatives constantly say is that government runs your life. That government, you know, government is too powerful, it interferes with your life, and so on. But the reality is that corporations run your life. Have you ever thought about it for a minute? Think first about your HMO. Are you going to get an authorization or not? Right? It's not up to you. I decide I'm going to get an authorization. No. Your HMO decides whether you're going to get an authorization, whether you're going to get that health care. But in addition, you get to decide whether your cell phone is going to work in an area or not. You'd better find a place where your cell phone works. Okay? Or, what about the cell phone fees you're going to pay? Are they reasonable or not? Well, mine aren't. What about all sorts of other products that are made? Does anybody here ever have a problem getting a size of clothes or of shoes? You know, think about it. Other companies decide what sizes they're going to be and whether they will fit, who they will fit and who they won't fit, right? That's not terrible or anything, but it's a fact. And this is true of all sorts of products, of things that are done, et cetera, whatever is offered to you. Luckily, we have lots of wonderful things available in this country for lots of people and lots of other things that are not available or that you are, you know, you have to take what's given to you. And what's happening is less and less, in many cases, it is being given to you. That is, as companies seek more and more profit, what they do is they try to cut back on customer service. Anybody ever get anybody from outside the country when they called customer service? Anybody ever calls customer service and not press buttons? 1, 2, 3, 4, right? Right? What's happening is that corporations are making you work for them. With your time, right? That's one of the ways in which they maximize profit. They're there to maximize their profit. And this is a reality. I'm not saying it's good or bad. It's simply real. What really is running your life and structuring your life is the way corporations function in this country. Should they function differently? That is really up to the voters of this country. And I mean that. It's up to who you elect and what kinds of corporations are possible and so on. Then there's an issue that always comes up, the 1% versus the 99% issue, where 1% of the country owns 40% of the nation's wealth. Or, as Joe Stieglitz recently pointed out, the six people who own Walmart have more wealth than the bottom 185 million people in America. Right? Now, you might say, well, what's wrong with that? You know, they made their money. Great. Well, Stieglitz points out something important. When you have an inequality of wealth that is that great, opportunity is stifled. That is, there's a point at which the inequality gets so great that so much wealth is concentrated in certain places that other people can't have access that wealth to go to college, to get training, to have better lives, to live in decent places, and so on. That is, there's a point at which the distribution of wealth at that kind of amazing change. Notice over 30 years, the top 1% has become twice as wealthy as it was 30 years ago. It was pretty wealthy then. People were doing fine, you know, but twice as wealthy and accumulated twice as much wealth. What that did was take away opportunity, take away better places to live, you know, schools to go to, and so on. That is something that Stieglitz has pointed out, and he's right. And it's not discussed. So listen to some of the truths that are not discussed. One, the private depends on the public. Two, there's a limit to privatization, and it's moral. Three, corporations run your lives in lots of ways, much more than the government could possibly. And the huge inequality of wealth, enormous inequality of wealth in this country, stifles opportunity. Just very basic stuff. Then there are other things. What we have is on the right is a claim that the overwhelming problem is the debt, the deficit. Well, one of the things we know is that, and the assumption there is, that there are certain metaphors that are being used. Let me just give you a sense of the metaphors behind that. There's one metaphor that says that the wealth of the nation is the wealth of the government. It's not true. Right now, this country is richer than it has ever been if you take into account all the wealth of all the people and all the corporations. It has never been as rich as it is right now. But the wealth of the country, the wealth of all of that, is not the wealth of the government. Those are very different things. The second metaphor is that the budget of the government is a family budget. Utterly ridiculous. It's a joke. You know, the government, you know, can print money, for example. You know, I can't. Wouldn't mind it, but, you know, I can't. And the fact is, you can't either, unless you're very good at it. But don't tell anybody. In general, the idea is that the government is not that way. And in fact, one of the interesting things that Paul Krugman pointed out this week is that people who have a great deal of wealth right now are buying government bonds with a negative interest rate. They're special bonds that go up in value with inflation. And what they do is they protect your wealth. So if you have a spare $10 million to put away while you spend your other $10 million on whatever you're doing, you can buy $10 million of these bonds. And if there's inflation, they will go up in value. But you actually pay the government 0.6% for these bonds. You don't get interest, you pay interest. And the government is getting lots of people doing this. Namely, there are people giving money to the government right now, cutting down on our debt. Very interesting phenomenon. I don't know if the people in this, if you folks out there are doing them, how many of you are buying these bonds, but I'm not. But, you know, this is a real phenomenon. That is, right now, you know, and it was predicted that if we didn't, you know, cut the budget drastically, then, you know, the interest rates would go up, inflation would go up, and so on. It hasn't at all. So that was wrong. What will help the economy? What helps the economy is people having money to spend. Another truth. It's not, quote, austerity. It's not, quote, tightening the family, the belt, right? That's another metaphor, as if the country were a person, you know, who could just lose weight by starving himself. You know, that isn't how it works. What you wind up doing is actually starving individuals, which isn't very good, and certainly not good for the economy. So in the current debates about economic issues, there are fundamental truths not being said. Now, framing is about ideas. It's not, you know, the words matter, but you have to find the words that express those ideas. But it's about the ideas. And what I've been talking about right now is ideas. Right? And these are true truths. Ideas that express truths that Democrats are not saying. And that Republicans should think about and try to see what they think about them. But they're not saying them, but we are. And that's what this book is for. It's for to express those truths. We can go through other issues. We can bring up issues about immigration, issues about women's rights, and so on. They're all discussed here as well. There's a lot of other issues discussed. But I think I'll stop here, because I think that gives you some feeling for what this book is about. Thank you.
Thanks, George, for sharing your insights with us. We've got a lot of questions.
Great.
I developed a lot of questions, but the audience has developed even more since they paid. I think we'll start with their questions. So, first you write that moral values shape our view of the world and how we react to discussion of public issues. But where do the values come from? Where do we get our moral values?
Ah, there's another couple of books you should read. In The Political Mind, there's a nice chapter for us, a nice good section on that. It has to do with what are called primary metaphors. These are ways in which we learn just by living in the world as children and growing up. We learn neural circuits that link two different kinds of experiences and metaphorically. So let me give you a simple example. If you eat healthy food, you feel good. If you eat rotten food, you'll feel bad. It's, you know. So you're better off if you eat healthy food than rotten food. Well, what is morality about? Morality is about well-being versus ill-being, your well-being and the well-being of others. So we have a metaphor that morality is what? Morality is purity. Immorality is rottenness. There's something rotten in the state of Denmark. That was a rotten thing to do, right? Or take another simple example. Any one-year-old knows that it's better to be able to stand up and walk on the ground than to have to crawl on the floor, right? Morality is uprightness, right? What is immorality? Being a low-down snake, underhanded, etc. Okay? Now, there are a couple of dozen of these things that tell you what kinds of metaphors for morality we have, and they're around the world. Just about every culture has purification rituals of some sort. But among those are a couple of other things. The first is you're better off if you have the things you need than if you don't. Right? So well-being is wealth. And that says you get from that the idea that rich people are better than poor people. Right? Now think of the word poor, which can either mean not having money or of poor quality. You know, think of a rich life, which is of high quality. Right? That is, that metaphor is there, and it has to do with something that you every child knows. It's better to have the things you need than if you don't. But there are two others that have to do with families. One of them is that you're better off if you listen to your parents and if you don't, assuming that your parents care about you. And the second is that you're better off if your parents take care of you and nurture you than if they don't. The first gives rise to a view that morality is obedience to a legitimate authority. The second one says morality is nurturance. Those give rise to two models of the family, a strict father family and a nurturing parent family, which are the basis of conservative and progressive thought. And we can go through that in great detail if you want. I have a book called Moral Politics, which goes through it in 500 pages. Easy to read, but still 500 pages of meticulous detail. And if you want the shortened version of that, the very shortened version is in here, and an intermediate length version is in The Political Mind. But the point is that that is the basis of this difference. And as I said, since we have both experiences, most of you have both models in your head, and when one is active, the other is inactive, and they can be about different things and different subject matters.
So this is a follow-up question. How do the frames change as we age, or do they?
Well, it's not clear. I mean, first of all, I don't think there's a single answer to that. Mm-hmm. I think it has to do with your environment. It has to do with what you hear every day. So, for example, if you're in an environment where what you hear every day is right-wing discussions with right-wing language and right-wing framing, that will affect you tremendously. Let me give you an example of that. By the way, this is happening in this country with Democrats in Congress who are mainly, you know, saying, oh, we have to worry about the debt and the deficit and, you know, we have to make cuts and so on, rather than we have to invest. But the same thing happens in Denmark. I recently was invited to Denmark to work with two members of the ruling parties. There's a socialist party coalition of four parties. And I talked to two of them there, and I talked to labor leaders. And what I heard from all of them was that they're doing things that they don't believe. That the socialist parties there are coming up with conservative legislation. And they don't like it, and their people who voted for them don't like it. And you talk to them, you say, well, why are you doing this? And they say, well, that's all there is discussed in public discourse. We have no other way to think about it. And so I took out the book and said, hey, you know, start thinking about it. But it takes a while. It's not something you do overnight. And what's happened there is, and the same thing happened to the labor unions. The labor unions recently changed a contract in which they increased their hours and cut their pay and so on in response to austerity measures, which were brought in saying because the government doesn't have as much money as it had before, we should just have austerity. Now, they're not on the euro, so they don't have to do what the euro countries do. They could invest in their future, rather than go through austerity. But all they hear day and night is austerity, austerity, austerity. They don't have another way of thinking about it in terms of what the economists here have pointed out, which is that the only way you build your economy is by putting money in people's hands when times are tough. You invest in it. When times are good, that's when you pay off your debts. Okay? You know, that's basic economics, but that isn't in the discourse even in Denmark. And so you find that in Denmark they're cutting health. In Denmark, they're cutting back on education. In Denmark, where you have, you know, probably the best safety nets around, in the world, possibly, they're cutting back on it because that's all they hear.
Okay. Why are conservatives and Republicans better at framing than Democrats and liberals? Are they smarter? Are they better coordinated? Are they just lucky?
Well, first of all, they're smart. And, there's a prejudice among liberals that says, conservatives must be ignorant or dumb or mean or greedy and so on, when, in fact, they're operating in terms of a different moral system. But there's another reason that's a very deep reason that has to do with university education. If you are a conservative and you go to college and you study business, one of the things in your curriculum is marketing. And what marketing professors study is how the brain works. They study images, they study emotions, they study metaphors, they study frames. They know how the brain works and they teach it. So marketing is second nature to folks who are in charge of the communication system of conservatives. Not necessarily all conservatives, but the communication system. Now, when Democrats go to college, if they're interested in politics, they study political science, law, economics, and public policy. They don't study marketing, and they don't study how the brain works. There's no neuroscience required. There's no cognitive science required. There's no linguistics required. They don't learn how people really think. Instead, they learn a theory that comes from about 1650, from which is what's called Enlightenment reason, which was wonderful in 1650. You know, Descartes got, you know, this out there, and, you know, the idea that that the way the church would rule in terms of its form of reasoning was overthrown. Very important at that time. But what it said was all thought is logical, all thought is conscious, emotion goes against thought when emotion is actually required for reason and so on. It got it all, it got virtually every principle incorrect. Now, it's not that you don't want to use that sort of reasoning, because in many cases it's appropriate. But in many other cases, as in politics, it's not appropriate. That is not how people really think. And that's not how elections run, and not how the country is run. So what is needed in the universities is that people who are studying all in all of these fields need to learn how people really think. And it's now not required in any university I know of.
Including mine.
And mine.
You almost always use the word progressive and rarely liberal. Why is that?
There's an interesting history in this. During the Vietnam War, you had Cold War liberals. So liberal got to be a bad name among progressives, as well as later on in terms with conservatives. So conservatives, starting in 1967 when Nixon was running for office, Nixon had a problem. How was he going to get working people to vote for him when in 1964 Goldwater was defeated and everybody wanted to be a liberal? You know, working people were in good unions, they had good union jobs, liberalism was great. By 1967, three things had changed. First, the Vietnam War protesters came along, and many working people had been in the military and resented the protesters as being anti-military. So Nixon ran on anti-communism. Then the women's movement came along, and a lot of working men were paternalistic at home, and Nixon ran on traditional family values. And then in 1965, you got the civil rights legislation, and especially in the South, many working men were afraid that people of color would take their jobs. Or were racists. And so Nixon ran on law and order and against school busing. Okay? And they created conservative populism, but they did one more thing. They added the idea of the liberal elite. That is, liberals look down their nose at working people. They, you know, drink lattes and they eat sushi and, you know, et cetera. And, you know, they're snobs and they look down on working people. And they've repeated this since 1967. And the Democrats didn't know what hit them. They created conservative populism. At the same time, on the left, you get the reaction against Cold War liberals in the Vietnam War period and against neoliberalism in terms of globalization today. So the word liberal got it on both sides. Now, when John Podesta formed what became the Center for American Progress in 2003-2004, he had to choose a name. This was set up for Hillary Clinton's run for presidency in 2008, and it was a think tank for progressives, what became called progressives. And what he did is he took a poll, and he said, how many people like the word liberal? Do you like the word progressive? 25% of the people liked the word liberal, 82% liked progressive.
Okay.
It became progressive.
Okay, that certainly answers that question. Here's another question. How do you change the frame of swing voters?
You have to teach something about the brain. When I mentioned mutual inhibition, that you have your moral systems are in circuits, and if the moral systems contradict each other, that means that the activation of one inhibits and turns off the other. And this is not just about politics. I mean, here, let's give a case of two moral systems that many people have that contradict each other and that switch back and forth and they don't even notice. Just think about Saturday night and Sunday morning morality. Right? Okay? Normal. This happens in normal brains. Right? Now, with swing voters, what happens is that these are what I call biconceptual. They have both moral systems. And they're in the same brain, and they mutually inhibit each other. But, and they may be about different things, or they may be sufficiently close to each other so that they can understand an issue from both perspectives, back and forth, depending on what they hear most and on what frames are activated in their brains. In 2010, people who were, quote, swing voters and like that, who in 2008 heard about hope and progressive ideas and empathy and all of those things, voted for Obama. In 2010, something else happened. They heard from the Tea Party, but they also didn't hear the same things from Obama. So the question is, well, how did Obama change? What happened? Well, let me give you a feeling for what happened. Let me give you some background. Before Obama took office, he took a poll, and I talked to his pollster. And his pollster said, well, we're getting these very interesting results. Our job is to find out what should go into the president's health care plan, what provisions the people most want, We're trying to give people what they need and what they want, what they care about. And here we've got a list of, you know, a couple dozen provisions that people like between 60 and 80%. And those are the provisions that went in there, like no preconditions. No caps, you know, if you have cancer, they can't cap the amount they pay for treatment and so on. You can keep your college age child on your health insurance till they're 26, right? People like that, and they still do, right? So Obama thought that being a policy wonk was the right thing to do, that if he got all the right policies, people would like his legislation. Now, conservatives never attacked those issues. You never heard a conservative say, yes, we should have preconditions. Ever hear it? Ever heard him say, yes, we should have caps. No, we shouldn't allow your kid to be on your insurance. You know, no conservative ever attacked any of the provisions that people liked 80%. They didn't do it at all. What did they do? They switched frames. They went to another part of the brain. They went to a moral system, their moral system, and they said, we're going to take two moral principles, which are conservative moral principles, our understanding of freedom and life. We're going to talk about government takeover and death panels. Government takeover, death panels, government takeover, death panels, government takeover, death panels, over and over again. The result is, though people still mostly like and still do like most of the provisions very, very well, the popularity of the overall plan has dropped below 50%. And this week, there was a very interesting thing. I read in the paper, I think it was this morning, that one of the provisions said that insurance companies that work through, large corporations, and large groups of people, have to spend at least 80% of their money on health care. Now, before that, normally, insurance companies get a half of the money, about 30% on the average of the money you pay for health care doesn't go to health care at all. It goes to profit to investors and managers and to a large administration whose job is to deny you care if they possibly can. That is, they try to see if you really qualify for those things, and then if they can find a reason why you don't, then they tell you, and they spend a lot of money doing that. And this says, well, at least 80% has to go to actually go to healthcare, and if they don't, they have to give money back to people. And all of a sudden, people around the country started getting checks in the mail for $800, $1,000, and reporters went out, interviewed these folks, and they said, well, I don't really like the plan as a whole, but I like this provision.
Right. This is a two-part question, but the first part is more of a comment than a question, so I'm going to read it all together. So the first part is, isn't someone who ignores the role of the public in their universe called a sociopath, not merely a conservative? And the second part is related. Is there any form of neuro-linguistic programming that can be incorporated into democratic messaging to rewire conservative brains or frames?
Okay. There's a little bit of real neuroscience as opposed to neuro-linguistic programming, which isn't real neuroscience. And I know that. John Grinder was a student of mine who founded the whole movement in 1972. And if you actually picked up his first book, The Structure of Magic, it was based on a handout I gave in that class. But he got it wrong. Smart guy, and he's made a lot of money since then. But first of all, they're not sociopaths. They're normal human beings who have a conservative moral system mostly running their brain in their brains. Wherever they got it from, they, you know, in their home life perhaps, in their communities, the way they were brought up, however it was, it is normal for people to have strict father upbringings, for people to have to encounter that in our society. There are all sorts of parts of society that run that way. This is normal. It's going to happen. And you're going to find lots of people who have that moral view honestly. They really believe it. They're not sociopaths. They really believe it. And if they believe it, if that's what the only thing they have in their brain to understand the world, other things will be go in one ear and out the other. And that's just basic neuroscience, right? And we're not going to reprogram their brain. Now, what I'm suggesting is something different. I'm suggesting that progressives get a better concept, a better system of communication, and that they begin by bringing up the moral principles on which the country was founded and these deep truths. Now, the first question you should ask if you encounter somebody who has both moral systems, it's a very simple question. Do you care about your fellow citizens? Do you care about your fellow citizens? Do you care about your people in your community, about your family, about your children and their friends? Do you care about your country and other people who live here? Do you care about, you know, the people you work with? You know, and if so, how do you take responsibility to act on that care? What do you do? And how should other people take that responsibility, right? And notice that people have done that since the beginning of this country. Since the beginning of this country, the public built roads and bridges. They built schools. They built hospitals. They kept public records. They built public buildings to keep those records. You know, they had a patent office from the beginning of the country. You know, this was there in order for there to be decent private lives and private enterprise. The idea of interstate commerce and the regulation of it was to make interstate commerce better, easier to achieve. It wasn't to stop it. It was to regulate it like traffic flow. Right? That was what that was about from the beginning of this country. The private has always depended on the public from the beginning of this country.
Okay. Can Democrats also play the game of labels and sound bites? The war on women was a good start, but we didn't have, but we don't have enough.
It's not a good start. It's a sad start, and it's not accurate. There are a lot of conservative women out there who are buying into a strict father model of the family, and who are, you know, who go along with that. What is involved in a strict father model of the family is male privilege. The father is the boss of the family. He is in charge of things like reproduction, for example. Right? That's why there are laws in many states about spousal notification and parental notification in the cases of abortion. It's not just up to the women who, you know, would have to have the child they don't want being developed in their bodies. Right? They're not in charge of their bodies. Secondly, there are other things that are very important here. There was a story in the New York Times about a month ago, and it was a science story. The story had to do with what is called the morning after pill, very bad name, because it suggests that somehow this is an immoral act and it's something to deal with your previous immorality the night before. So you have the Morning After the Morning Act after pill do. Well, people had thought there was a folk theory that the morning after pill prevented a fertilized egg from being implanted in the womb. And that's false. It turns out what it does is prevent fertilization at all by two mechanisms. And that is crucial. Now, that appeared in the New York Times and other stories around the country, and not one conservative got up and said, great. Not one person who said we should have, something in the Constitution saying that a fertilized egg is a person. Nobody said we should encourage morning after pills to prevent murder. Right? Notice in Texas, at the same time, on virtually the same day, the Texas Republican Party put in its plank the idea that a fertilized egg is a person. But not one Texas Republican said, yes, we should encourage morning after pills to prevent murder. They wanted to have people who had abortions be tried for murder. Now, you know, this is very serious, but it doesn't have to, it has to, everything to do with male privilege, which is coming out of a strict father model. And many women accept it. Conservative women all over, yes, Michelle Bachmann. You know, ask Sarah Palin. They accept it. And this is serious. This isn't a war against Sarah Palin or Michelle Bachmann. It's not a war on women in general. It's not a war as such. This is a war to get conservative dominance in every area of our lives. And it's very important to understand why that is so. When you study the details of the conservative moral system, and the place to look at this is in the book called Moral Politics, where the 500-pager, in chapter 9. Sorry, guys, I'm an academic. But when you look at the details of it, there is a highest principle in the conservative moral system. And that highest principle is to defend and extend and support the moral system itself. And where does that come from? In a strict father family, the one thing that cannot be questioned is the authority of the father. And you map that on to conservatism, and the one thing that has to be maintained and expanded is the authority of conservatism itself. Now, what does that explain? First of all, if the president comes along and says, well, conservatives have a good idea for this, I'll compromise with them, we'll attack the deficit by doing some things I want, and here are some things they want, let's do it. The conservatives will vote against it. Why? The extreme conservatives will vote against it. Why? Because it would help Obama, which would be against helping conservatism. They're going to do, you know, why do they, you know, want to stop certain legislation? Why do they want to, you know, kill Obama's health care plan? Because it goes against conservatism. It goes against conservative ideas. So they're going to do, if they're extreme conservatives, their moral principles tell them that this is what they have to do. The Tea Partiers may actually believe those moral principles. And one mistake that a lot of progressives make is that they think that conservatives who act like this are just voting because of millionaires who give them money. That is just about money. It's not about money for most of those people. It may be about money for some of them. For, you know, it's true that the Koch brothers are giving money to support these guys, but why are they running? Why are they bothering to run? Why do they care? Why do people support them? Because they have a different moral system, and that moral system tells them this is what they should do. And it's because and in the case of biconceptuals, people who are the swing voters, who determine the elections in these campaigns, if they hear their language over and over, they're going to hear their moral system over and over, and it's going to be strengthened. What does this say about liberals? It says that if you use conservative language even to argue against it, you're helping conservatives. If you use conservative language and conservative frames even to argue against it, you're helping conservatives. So turn on MSNBC, or Current TV, and you will hear, Glenn Beck said this. Here's the argument he gave, point one, two, three, and four, and here are the facts against it. Right? You're using all those language. You're not developing the alternative language that would, and you're not telling the deep truths and the moral basis of those truths. That's what this book is about. It says, that's what you need to do, and here's how to do it.
Thanks, George. I'm afraid we've come to the point in our program where we have time for just one last question, and several people have asked how you would advise President Obama to modify his messages in this campaign.
In exactly the way I just said. In 2008, President Obama did something quite wonderful. He talked about empathy over and over. Edwin Rutsch has a YouTube station about empathy. You know, put in Edwin and empathy and you'll get it. 88 clips of Obama talking about empathy. You know, he was asked, for example, what's the most important thing your mother taught you? Empathy. How to put yourself in someone else's shoes. What's the basis of patriotism? Citizens caring about each other. And so on. In speech after speech, he talked about the real moral basis of this country. And he talked about what it meant and why hope was a positive thing. But it wasn't just hope about that was nebulous. It was hope about the idea that empathy would rule, that was what the government was about. He stopped talking about empathy because he got intimidated by conservatives in the media. And when did this happen? In the Sotomayor case, when Sotomayor was coming up for the Supreme Court, and he said, we need a justice who has empathy. And the conservatives didn't understand empathy. They took it as sympathy. They took it as being prejudiced in favor of one party versus another. And they said empathy meant that, when it didn't. And they may not even know what empathy means. But the point is that he got intimidated. He has to stop being intimidated. He has to say all those things.
Thank you, George. And I hope everyone here has enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank George Lakoff, UC Berkeley professor and author of The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic. Thanks to our audience here in San Jose and those of you joining us on TV and the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley is adjourned.